Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're going to start. The provost is on his way, but he's going to be a couple minutes late. But I know Michelle has to go, so we're gonna get going. Welcome to Town Hall. We have two important invited guests, so my remarks will be short. But we thought that we would start before getting into the fun stuff. We would just start. One of the traditions of our faculty council is that we use this occasion to mark the passing of members of the faculty. So I would like to ask for a minute of silence for the people whose names you see there: Harvey Brown, Richard Kahn, John Siegel, and Peter Parry. Thank you. So, here's the agenda. I will give you an update. Professor Massey will come and give us a talk about the budget and other amusing items. And Professor Goldstein will tell us about the CFI outcomes and Quartier d'Innovation. There's not much really going on. So we worked, when I say we, I mean Diana worked for a while to come up with some stories. There was some story about some new principle yesterday that you may have heard about. And so many of us are very, very excited about the appointment of the 17th principal. I've talked to several people who know her personally and have worked with her, and I think the selection committee gets 5 stars for excellent work. They also get an amazing number of stars for keeping it confidential as long as conceivably possible. It's really great to see good news. I want to talk about there is other good news. We've had appointments. You can see the smiling faces of people like Philippe Gros, who is our Vice Dean Life Sciences. You can see Joanne Liebosch smiling there, who has been appointed as the permanent head of development for the faculty. Rob Kearney, who has taken on the job of interim director of biomedical engineering. He told me it's his third time being the chair of that department. And Dan Deckelbaum, who has kindly taken on the job of being the interim leader for our international health initiative. You're probably wondering what's going on with some other things. Well, we're going to hear about the budget from the provost. I'm sure you know that there was a sommet sur l'enseignement supérieur recently. And during that, there was a gracious consideration on the part of the government to relax the draconian cuts by allowing us to pay them back over many years. Tony will tell you that all about it in a few minutes. In the context of these budget cuts, something that I've mentioned at several meetings, we have already initiated a new process in the faculty to try and bring our budget into the 21st century. And Pascal Morgan, who is not here today, but Pascal has been working diligently with her team to meet with all the units in the faculty with the goal of eventually developing a zero-based budget type of budgeting process for the faculty, something we've needed for a while, and it will allow us to at least know why we don't have enough money to pay for all the things you guys want. Some of you may have noticed that the hospitals have been in the newspaper. What can I tell you about that? So first of all, the first thing I tell you is I think tomorrow the CHI-HI data will come out, and you will see that our hospitals are extremely highly performing, each and every one of their in their own categories. Our teaching hospitals are actually outstanding from a clinical point of view, and at least as good, if not better, than most of their peers in Canada. Later in April, you will see similar data. Hi, Tony. Later, you will see similar data from there goes the rest of that talk. There you'll see similar data from ACES, from the I was going to pick it up. It's okay. Similar data from ACES. On the other hand, I think we all know that there are problems. They're particularly concerning at the Jewish General, where there's been enormous pressure on the budget, despite lots of evidence that the hospital is very efficient. on St. Mary's, where a construction project which was approved by the previous government is sort of a little bit on hold. At the Douglas, which needs a new, whole new campus, and it hasn't gotten going. And most of all, on the MUHC, let me tell you that the MUHC people are often very concerned. People read things in the newspaper. They talk about people in the Bahamas and so on. I spent about 3 hours today there, with a lot of it with Normand Renfrais and Claudio Bassandri, the chair of the board. And like the Cruises, I was at a meeting this morning of the foundation of the MUHC. I think we're despite what it says in the newspaper, people need to know that there is an initiative to really change things at the MUHC. I think you're going to see that there are going to be changes in the way the administration works. And I'm optimistic that going forward, the hospital will actually use this crisis to become much more efficient. It has to, because in 2 years it's moving to the Glen, and there really is no choice. So I remain cautiously optimistic that things will go better, but it's a tough time right now. I wanted to just mention, oh, I forgot David Wright, who has taken on the interim directorship of IHSP. Before introducing the provost, there's a couple of other little items I wanted to mention. There are things going on like a new curriculum. Some of you may have heard of it in the undergraduate medical school. There will be a special town hall on April 4th to update people on the new curriculum. I know many people have given feedback about that, but it's actually another opportunity, a final opportunity, to give feedback and hear about it. I wanted to mention that the Rossi Foundation gift that some people know about, in which is a gift from the Rossi Foundation to help improve the quality of cancer care, has basically been approved by all parties, and there will be a launch coming up in May, a public launch, and that's very exciting. I met today with Philippe about the strategic research plan, which is coming along extremely well. There's also an educational strategic plan being run by Linda Snell and John Orlovsky, and they tell me that they are moving forward with a committee which is in place and is in the process of doing a SWOT analysis, a sort of a survey of where things are at in anticipation of being able to report back later in terms of progress there. I wanted to remind people that we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders, so we're expecting lots of celebrations there. Some of you may remember that I was in the news at one point about asbestos. I probably will be in the news again about asbestos, because we're going to have a conference in the fall about asbestos, as I promised the Senate, so that will be, watch for that. That, it looks like it's going to be very interesting. We've initiated a new series of lectureships. Actually, it's an old series, but we've reinitiated it, called the Andrew F. Holmes Dean of Medicine Distinction Lectures of Distinction, which used to be called the Foundations of Medical Science series. We're going to have speakers in May and fall, and we have someone coming up named Professor Françoise Barry-Sinoussi, who's a very well-known scientist from the Institut Pasteur, one of the co-discoverers of HIV, and she will be speaking in around convocation time. And then we have some kudos. Malcolm Sonnenberg has been named a fellow of the American Association of the Advancement of Science. We have a number of Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal winners, including Professors Mackey and Necka, as well as, I think, Ernesto Schifrin. There may be others, but these are the ones that I have. Dr. Terry Hebert, Kevin Washke, and Lenora Lala have been awarded 2013 Certificate of Merit Awards of CAME, the Canadian Association for Medical Education. Peter McLeod has been honored by the AFMC for his outstanding contributions to faculty development over his career, which is an extraordinary honor. Dr. Eduardo Franco was elected to the Brazilian Academy of Sciences as a foreign fellow. And Michelle Roseman, a PhD student, was just on Monday was given one of the new Étudiants Chercheurs Étoiles recognitions by the FRQ for her publication reporting of conflict of interest in drug trials in Cochrane Reviews, a cross-sectional study, which was published in BMJ. So the faculty continues to be an exciting place. There's lots of good things going on. Lots of positive news, lots of interesting appearances in the radio and the news, newspapers. But unfortunately, we also have to deal with the administrative realities of life. And here to talk about those realities are two of my favorite people. The first one is Professor Massey, our beloved provost, who has the fun job of telling us about the budget. Tony.
Good news in the faculty, and I have to come and give some bad news, I guess. Okay, thanks. So, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak to a town hall up here in Medicine. I enjoy coming, and I enjoy the questions that I usually get when I make such a presentation. In fact, instead of starting with a presentation, I thought I would switch the order and give you an opportunity to ask questions about anything you want. It's always a dangerous thing. I didn't plant any questions in the audience, but I thought I would give you an opportunity to do that. So I see hands waving up here.
He mentioned you might have missed his. I'm Ken Hastings, by the way, for those who don't know me. David, you mentioned that you have a new budget process aiming for a zero-based budget. And so the question for you and Tony, I guess both, is to what extent is that integrated with the university's response to the budget cuts, and to what extent is that an independent initiative that has its own history and its own life and just happens to be playing out at the same time?
So the answer is that it was an independent initiative, which we would have had to do when the budget cuts came, but we started it before the budget cuts. It will allow us over time to deal better with the budget cuts than sound budgetary process. But the university as a whole, Tony will tell you, is going towards
modern budgetary process.
We have two.
That's my second. So there are two different initiatives at the university for budget reform. The first was to lay the groundwork for a better integration between the actual finances of the university and the allocation mechanisms we have. In the interest of transparency, we labeled the project FBI, so you could do it that way, please. And the second is a move toward activity-based budgeting for the individual units, which will follow in budget year 14-15. So this year we've done the integration, and we will have now to adjust our expectations to the actual budgetary realities, the allocation realities that we have. And then after that, we will move to a new model of allocating budgets on the basis of activities. So instead of the central administration receiving all of the revenues and then distributing them, there'll be a model. We'll have the money coming into the individual units that generate the revenues, and then there will be taxation for services. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Basically, the terms of action at the moment, you're talking about planning the budget, not implementing a budget. Is that right? I mean, what I'm hearing is about planning, not about implementing, on both the faculty and the community.
So I think that there's clearly that we can't just plan a budget. We have to actually have to distribute the resources that go along with being able to accomplish what's been asked. So in the process of our budgetary planning up until now, we have had something called an agreement or a compact with the faculty for marginal increases in their revenues being marginal revenues being given to them to faculties to work on priority items. But we haven't reassessed the way in which those allocations have been made historically. So there's a very heavy history to allocations, right? And we're looking to change that model to activity-based, and that will force both the central administration and the units to be more efficient in the way they approach it. The models in Canada are the University of Toronto and the University of British Columbia. The University of Saskatchewan has been trying to move in this direction. One of the things that always comes up is right now in our central model, space is paid for centrally, but it's used locally, so deans never have enough space. As soon as you make it the case that the deans will be paying for the space that they occupy, a market magically emerges and people start saying, we don't need all the space that we have. So I think we have to be careful about how far down this road we
I'm
go.
I'm looking forward to that opportunity.
Yes, so am I, actually. Someone else had their hand up. Yes. So we already deal with it. So how do you deal with units that don't generate sufficient funds to cover their own costs? Inside the university, we already do an enormous amount of internal subsidization. So part of a taxation system in an activity-based budgeting model would be to ensure that certain priorities are determined by the academic leadership and that funds would flow to allow them to continue. I certainly think it would be the case, speaking from my own faculty, which is arts, that we would have a difficult time justifying the teaching classics because it wouldn't generate a sufficient amount of money for the number of professors you need and the programs of study that are offered. But a good university probably should have a classics department. So you think about it in those terms. Units that don't generate sufficient revenues would then be encouraged, however, to think about ways of diversifying and enhancing their own revenues. And I would like that to happen so that then I could tax you on what you earn.
Other questions for the provost? Wow. Oh, there you go. Three times chair.
Three times in your route, hopefully. This is my favorite question. Right now, we don't, as chairs or deans, really know which unit is a cost center and a profit center. So I don't know, I can guess, in terms of, for example, should we focus on PhDs, master's student, undergraduate teaching? So are we going to get information which will tell us these things?
Absolutely. In fact, the deans already know. Because we had a process, we had something called an SRI, a Strategic Reframing Initiative, in which we had one project that dealt with costs and revenues coming into the university. And we broke it down by every single program at the university, so several hundred. We have it down by faculty, department, and program. And so we've been analyzing and looking at those numbers, and the deans have had access to them if they wanted to look at them. But we haven't yet moved to having an activity-based budget. So the way in which you get revenues, and I'm looking further ahead because the chair of cell biology is there, and he knows that exactly how much each student in his department generates from a full-time equivalent student because he asked the question. So it's a good question to ask. So we actually know that there's a cost factor weighted grid. The Quebec government funds each student taking a course at the undergraduate level according to the discipline in which they're studying. And if it's a credit-based program at the master's level, they also fund them by credit hour. The credit hours are weighted by the discipline. So if you're an art student, you get a weight of one. If you're an agriculture student, you get a weight of almost 4.5. Right? Then there's a multiplier for level, master's with or without a thesis, and PhD, and those multipliers can be also in the order of 3 or 4 times. So it's not that complicated. It's certainly not rocket science. You could figure out whether or not your unit is generating sufficient revenues to pay the salaries of the individuals who are employed there. We do that all the time, and that's why I know there's a lot of internal subsidization, because some units simply do not generate revenues sufficient to pay the salaries of the people who are there. Now, sometimes that's because of history. People have been a long time, department has aged, the number of students has remained relatively constant, but the professor's salaries have gone up with their with their chronological age. So it's not going to be easy, but you can certainly calculate it, and we do unit by unit. Now, of course, you could slip further, and I won't do this, but somebody might ask, are you generating your salary, right, individually? Because then you could do an analysis not only of the unit, but of the individuals and wonder whether or not there is a balance there and what could be done. The second thing you have to worry about is that that's not the only way in which we generate revenues. Rosie will tell you, I'm sure, that professors who generate research grants also generate indirect costs for the university, indirect cost recoveries for the university. They also generate indirect costs, but the indirect cost recoveries, the indirect cost recoveries allow the university not to charge for certain things, cleaning, snow removal, gardening, you know, hazardous waste removal, right? Those are things that are covered centrally because they're indirect costs that come into the university. You'd have to recalculate those on the basis of what the granting council is and how much money actually came in. If you get a Quebec grant, from if there are any left after the cuts, you'll wind up bringing in 40, 50, or 60 cents additional that goes into the university's general budget. If you get a federal grant, we get 17 cents, right? And it's flat. Quebec differentiates by discipline. The federal government, it's flat. And it's actually a decreasing function of how many research dollars you have. So the more research dollars you have, the lower the rate you get. So
opposite of the U.S. system.
The opposite of the U.S. So McGill, Toronto, and UBC, and I think now Montreal, are in the low end of the indirect cost recovery rates at 17 cents, and Bishop's and Acadia are at the top end at 70 or 80 cents. I don't know if those numbers are exact.
I'd like to follow up on what you just talked about. So the definition of unit is a bit bizarre to me. You look at David when talking about unit is at the faculty.
Right.
And for the basic science department, most of our teaching is at the science faculty. So is the unit the science faculty, or is coming to the faculty?
It's the unit that has the course number in front of it. That's how Quebec funds. So if there's a biochem, right, then that is going to be the teaching grant for biochem.
So it's very reassuring, I think, for many of our...
It's not the student, not where the student... There is a small amount of the tuition revenue that goes to the unit that's managing the degree. But the teaching grant from Quebec comes to the credit hour, right? Then they count the hour. However, I want to make one other point on funding. PhD students are funded a lot of money for 3 years and 3 months. So if you have a PhD student who's in his or her fourth year, there is zero revenue coming into the university. And many people, some of them in your faculty, conveniently like to forget that when they argue about distribution of resources.
So one of the things that concerns me a bit about thinking of units as revenue generators is if I look at undergraduate teaching in science, for example, there's very high-quality teaching going on there. Let me start in particular departments. But if I look at how many students are doing undergraduate courses in different departments, and I won't name them, they're disproportionate to the way I would design an undergraduate science curriculum for a general student coming into McGill. And if you now re-entrench our units to encourage this large number of students with a payback, I think it will stop the reorganization we should do to make efficient use of our teachers in general area.
So that's why, thinking back to Michelle's point, when he said, I looked at David, absolutely, because we still want there to be academic leadership to take some important decisions about redistributing things. Units that don't generate sufficient revenues, units that instead should be encouraged to redesign their curriculum, cannot be managed simply by the amount of money that they individually generate. That's why you have a faculty, and that's why you have a university to make those decisions. You might not like all the decisions that are made, but they're there to do that. It's a pretty quiet group for...
They're always quiet.
Really?
We don't serve the booze till after.
Why don't I come back? Can I come to that? Yeah, that's a good question about... So what's the budget, the budgetary implications of where we presently find ourselves? I'm going to run quickly through what we know. So what we currently know for the political context of decisions is that tuition is frozen. So going into the summit, right, we knew that tuition was to be frozen at the fiscal year 12 levels, and that represented a $19 million cut for McGill in both fiscal year 13 and 14. They announced the cuts in December. Our budget year started in May. So the effect of that was, let's take the break and come back in the new year and look at what we have to do. And that meant that we had 16 months to spend $40 million less. That's $3 million a month that was supposed to cut out of our expenses. Right? That's quite a hefty amount of money to cut out. And in addition, they communicated to us that the subvention conditionnelle of $32 million would be held back from McGill unless we made at least $19 million of those cuts by April of 2014. So those were the parameters. We actually don't know much more. We didn't know going into the summit what the increases would be based on to get us to fiscal year 16. And there was some promise of both indexation of tuition and indexation of the government grant so that if you put the smoke in the right place, the mirror would show more money. But in fact, there isn't any more money. And the implications were that this year, the year we're going to end, we're going to have a gigantic deficit, really big, astoundingly big, because we had budgeted this year going in with an expectation that we were going to get tuition revenues that would add $7 million to our budget, or $6.5 million to our budget. And we were going to have this $19 million of transfers, appropriations from the Quebec government, promised back in a year ago, in March of 2012. In addition, the Board of Governors said, if your budget prospects look that good, we're going to let you run a $7 million deficit this year as long as you catch up before the end of the five-year cycle of funding that was promised. So the lines that you see here, this red line is what our revenues would have been, and there's a gap in the right direction here, a gap in the wrong direction there, but over the five-year period, we would actually have been able to pay back some of our accumulated deficit of approximately $93 to $100 million. So we have a big accumulated deficit. But this is not a planned extension of the Green Line of the Metro. That is, in fact, the revenues after the announcement in December. So the gap is now quite big between what our revenues would be and what our expenses are actually going to be. So that creates a significant problem in terms of multi-year budgeting. I laugh at the thought. We're trying to do a multi-year budget, and I got four sets of instructions in a single year about how to prepare McGill's budget from the government. There will be increases in tuition. There will be indexation of your grant then. Oh, we're going to reduce the amount we give you in tuition from $325 to $254. Oh, we got a new government now. We're not going to give you any tuition increases. Oh, we're going to cut 5.2% out of your appropriation. It's very difficult to try to do a single year's budget, let alone a multi-year forecast, when they're doing this. So that's a big gap. These are the bottom line numbers that are quite scary. If you look at where we started, which was up here, a $7 million budget that included this $325 tuition increase. And we project that over 4 years, we would be actually in a surplus situation by fiscal year 16, and then 17 was going to be an even bigger surplus. The tuition increases that we're losing are multiplicative, right? Right? They go up by the $6 million every year because they were supposed to be $325, then plus $325, then plus $325. So when I went to the Board of Governors with a five-year budget plan, this is now the amount we have to subtract from our five-year plan. We have some ins and outs that are fairly common. When you have an operating budget of $700 million, you're going to have some fluctuation in your expenses. We revised it to think we were going to have a $12 million deficit. Instead, they announced a $19 million cut. So we're going to have a $33 million deficit in this fiscal year because of that. Now, in 192 years of McGill's history, we've managed to accumulate about $90 million in debt. And in 1 year, we're going to add 33% to it because of the way these cuts were announced. It's not fair. And if you project it out, and this is the scariest part, this is what we call a pre-gap or cash deficit, project it out to the next, to fiscal year 16, we'd go from about $100 million to $200 million in 4 years. So you do 200 years to get the first $100 million, and then in 4 years, you add another $100 million. That's an unsustainable situation. It cannot be sustained, and we have now little or no choice but to deal with it through some cuts. The core operating expenses, I took out everything else from this budget, took out and just said, let's look at the money we actually have to distribute from, and this goes back to how it was generated, from the operating budget of the university, tuition plus the government grant, leaving out all self-financed units, right? Those that cover their own expenses. So the residences cover their own expenses. They're not in here. Food services has to cover its own expenses. Athletics covers its own expenses. Services for students cover their own expenses. They're not actually on the operating grant. Students levied fees on themselves to pay for those services, and they're not being affected yet by these cuts. But 75% of everything we spend is on salaries and benefits. So if you just said proportionately we'll cut in the university's budget $40 million, and we wanted to do it equitably, and not that I'm saying we should do this, but if we did it equitably, then 30 of the $40 million in cuts would have to come from salaries and benefits. That's headcount or it's actual salaries, right, what we're paying people. So $40 million, that's the other thing. It's the compression of time. And there was a good question, I guess Kent asked a question about how the compression or the extension will affect it. $40 million is a lot of money by anybody's accounting. $3.x million a month is a lot to cut out if we were to do it in only the 2 years or a year and a half that's available. So it represents the entire cost to McGill of occupying, not student occupations, right, but occupying buildings, right? So 200, that would cover all of our buildings for a year. We could sell our portion of 680 Sherbrooke Street and get back about 75%, so $30 million. So it's more than that. It's $15 million more than the university makes in annual contributions to employee pension plan. And it is $10 million more than our spending on all small material items, including collections of the library. Right? So this is a huge, huge amount of money to try to get a handle on in a short period of time, because quite frankly, we live on the edge. Right? Our revenues and expenses are very tightly bound. And we've had periods of time, and I know I see Dean Cruz in the audience, in the 1990s, we had a miserable budgetary situation that we all had to live through because our revenues and expenses are so tightly bound around balancing that as soon as you get a dip in the revenues, your accumulated deficit goes up because so much of it is tied to people. And people have an expectation, and right, and so in the community, of being treated fairly themselves. But if the government doesn't treat the university fairly, it's really hard to maintain those promises. So we needed some principles to guide our decision-making going into making budget cuts. And the first thing, and I was happy to hear that there are two strategic planning exercises going on in the faculty, and I'm sure they're drawing very heavily on the university's strategic
plan. They are indeed.
That's what I wanted to hear. So that's one of the guiding principles. Are the things we're doing strategic? Are they actually enhancing the university's success? Right? Are they giving students the best possible education we can afford? And are we managing the resources responsibly? Those are the only three truly strategic things we do. So we have to face this understanding that we're going to have to take hard decisions. We have some guidance. And we have to come out of this. It's not going to last forever. We know we're going to come out of it. But we're going to have to come out of it poised to grow our strengths. If we start cutting across the board, if we don't make difficult decisions, we're going to come out of this weaker, not stronger, and that's going to hurt us. And we have to fight really hard to reverse bad public policy. Now, I want to be really clear. Sometimes Quebec is very progressive. That cost factor weighted grid that I talked about for how they fund individual students is actually not a bad model. It's not a block grant. It doesn't force us. We could actually tell now, because it's cost factor weighted, how much money to get in. It's flat, though. It's the average cost across the system. But we know how to calculate and optimize our enrollments. So we do better than most other universities in the system. What I mean by that is we're about 9% of the students in the system, and we get nearly 15% of the budget from Quebec. So we shouldn't always complain. We actually are doing well because of who we are. But these students who we have are heavily STEM and medicine, heavily graduate student. We get bigger subventions for them, but they cost more. Right? So that's why we're always at the edge. We have real wage pressures. I think we're the number one performing university in the country, number two or number three. Which ranking do you want to go by? We're one of the top three in the country. Our professors are among the lowest paid in the U15. And we've been struggling with this. We've already had to do some pay suspension of pay increases in the past because of budget compressions. But it's a fact that we need to do something about this because we want to be able to continue to attract people here, and we don't want to lose them once they've gotten here because we invest in them. So how do we do that? We have to try to get our salaries up. We also have legislation in Quebec which is called pay equity, and 12 years ago we actually had a settlement, but it was overturned, even though it was agreed to. It was overturned because of a complaint. We used the Treasury Board's methodology. The Treasury Board's methodology was overturned, and they told us we had to recalculate it, and now it's going to come to fruition. But that's a one-time-only payment that's going to make things worse, right? Second, we've got real pressure on our pension plan. It's really interesting when you think about it. We have this accumulated deficit, $100 million. We're paying 1% interest on it. So that means $1 million right off the top of the operating budget goes to passive interest. You have to pay the banker, right? On the other hand, so you say, oh, good, interest rates are low. Well, on the other hand, those low interest rates mean we get a lower payout from our endowment, and our pension plan suffers. So some financier somewhere probably thinks that's a natural hedge, right? On the other hand, it's, you know, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. So we have to be careful. But those pension liabilities do require, by law, that McGill make additional contributions to the pension plan this year and every year for the next 10 years, amounting to probably somewhere between $8 and $15 million a year. So that's huge. And then there are ongoing costs. We're not going to sacrifice money that's in Ottawa despite ourselves. So we have won two Canada Excellence Research Chairs, Green Chemistry and Pain. We're going to recruit for those people. We're not going to stop recruiting for those people. And those grants come with additional recruits, but it is in a targeted strategic area. But we're going to have to keep doing that. So we have to have also major external funds. And if you haven't noticed, we have a deferred maintenance problem. That's pretty serious. Now, sorry, Ken asked the question, what happened after the summit? Well, there are five major points we can make about the summit. The first is, Pauline Marois said, the cuts remain. And that's that. It's $40 million less to McGill, $124 million a year, or $250 million less to higher education in Quebec over a two-year period. That's the bottom line on the finances of the summit. Now, then there's some finessing, right? So we'll index tuition 3%. That's $70 gross per FTE. Just to be clear, an FTE at McGill is 30 undergraduate credits. So this is not huge increases. And it's gross because the Quebec government pulls back 35 or 40% for its own student aid program. We at McGill then pulled back another 30 cents to give students aid because we do believe in access and we think it's important that nobody be denied an education here because they can't afford it. On the other hand, this is not going to go very far.
What's the total dollar?
This would be just under $2 million. Under total. Under, yeah. Gross. Yeah, but this is the point I think that Ken was asking about, and that is, the multi-year amortization will just increase indebtedness. Right? We're going to carry that debt. It's at low interest rates for now, but we're going to carry that debt. I'm not willing to bet that 5 or 7 years from now, interest rates are still going to be at 1%. But somebody might want to take that bet. And we've got a hedge for them so that we can do that. So the increasing indebtedness is what that actually amounts to. And it's serious that we can was said in the summit by Pauline Marois, and that's this, right? The reinvestment from 14 to 29 and a revision of the funding formula, indexation of tuition fees, this she did, 3%, and it's going to stay that way. This is under study. This, she said, we're going to reinvest from 14 to 19, 2014 to 2019, if and only if the economic circumstances permit us to do so. Well, I was not going to be able to produce a five-year budget, I really promise, because I couldn't even do it four times in a year. I had to change the budget for the university this year. Then they set up a new legislation. They want to have new laws regarding universities, more controls, more bureaucracy. They want to have a national council on universities to oversee the stuff that they're not already overseeing. They want a new policy on research. Rosie may be aware of what that contains. I'm not completely convinced about what it is. And then they were going to increase student aid because they're going to have much more money to pay the $70 for 30 credits. So that's the outcome of that. I'm taking up too much of your time, but I want to say that achieving strategic academic priorities is what I really like to talk about, which is the academic mission of the university. And the budget should only be a tool that allows us to achieve these things and not the main event. But it's been the main event now for 3 years. It continues to haunt us in terms of trying to find an appropriate mechanism for keeping our books in balance. But I spent, Rosie and I actually went out to, we presented to Senate together, we've come to open forums, we've gone to councils, we set up working groups, we've had online submissions, and we actually, as I just said, there are three basic strategies for the university. What are you doing that's improving the success of the university? Research grant funding, educating students, placing them. The second thing is, are we thinking about our students and enhancing their education? And I think what David said is really important. We're also thinking about the curriculum and how it's designed and how it should work. And then last, are we managing the existing resources on a multi-year basis? Well, we're trying to diversify and optimize our revenue sources. That may mean rethinking the kind of university we are. Are we the right size? Should we be smaller? If we're smaller, what would that mean in terms of our revenue base? What would it mean in terms of the students that we do educate? Where would they come from? How dependent on Quebec can we continue to remain? These are big questions. But we also said that there were major strategic objectives for the university that we had to achieve. The first is, you can't be a really world-class university and forget about recruiting people, whether that's smaller, targeted, but you've got to go after talent where it's needed, and you have to have an academic hiring plan that works. It may not be a replacement ratio above one, but there has to be some replacement of our academic staff. The second thing is, what about our undergraduates and our graduate students? Are we doing something to improve their experiences? Are people collaborating across disciplines because it's the right thing to do, not just because they might get extra money for it? And are we giving good support to the support services? Our professionals at McGill, not just our academics, our professionals at McGill need to have career opportunities. We also have to manage to the numbers, and this sometimes upsets people. I'm not talking about are you bringing in your own salary, right? But are you performing as an academic up to the standards for which you receive tenure, okay, or for which you receive your appointment? That's an academic management issue that needs to be addressed. So we have to work on that. We also want to provide service to Quebec. We want to make sure that we encourage diversity and that we go back to something we really started as, a university founded on a professional faculty. Faculty of Medicine was the first teaching programs at McGill University, followed by the Faculty of Arts. But this is really important. Are we educating people to the professions in an appropriate way in this century? The Senate endorsed strategic academic priorities on the assumption that I would bring back to Senate anything that required governance oversight in terms of actions. And this is one of those areas where that I think is really important, and that's innovating in our learning environments. We're proposing something called MILE, McGill Innovative Learning Environments. We have to start rethinking limitations they have and their own sophistication with information, including information that can be mediated through the library, and their use of technology. And we can't do it alone, so we should be involved in innovative partnerships. And we just joined one last week, which is called edX, which is a coalition of right now 12 universities from around the world. Harvard and MIT started it. Texas and California came in with Georgetown and Wellesley. McGill, Toronto joined in Australian National University, and Lausanne from Switzerland joined recently. So there is an attempt to have a coalition of universities that will think through this problem of innovations in MOOCs, right, which are massively open online courses. And there's another one that's being proposed now, which is a SPOC, which is a small personalized online course. So those are the things that we're looking at. It's a consultative process, and in February we joined the consortium. We need next steps to coordinate, and I'm working with the deans, and we do want this process to be supported by careful analytics. Stay connected. On the budget cuts, you could write your suggestions or put them on the red blog. For ASAP, you can send that to, you can look up the paper at McGill.ca/ASAP, or send information to White Paper. I know Rosa still has something up for the strategic research plan. I've already taken questions at the beginning, but if there's one or two pressing questions, I can take those.
Any comments or questions for the provost? Dr. Chabelle.
Is there any consideration to changing the funding model?
So it would require a major rethink of what we are and what we do. $350 to $360 million coming from the government, reverse that and say that's a 4% payout on an endowment. We need an endowment just to generate that of, what, 12 to 15 million, billion. Then you'd have to go back and say, what about the buildings and all of the bond issues that have been put out that we're paying interest on? The government is underwritten. Would we have to pay them back for it? So we do think about these things, and we are modeling different scenarios for individual programs to go self-funded. We've done it with the MBA. We have a master's in manufacturing management. We have an MBA in Japan. So we do have individual programs that can go that route. And we think we'd like to get greater distance between ourselves and the Quebec government, even on the funded students. So we're looking to deregulate students. Our international students pay a forfaitaire. They pay an international tuition. The entire amount minus the Quebec tuition is extracted from our budget. Right? Now, we got them to agree that four programs would not, that wouldn't happen. Over the last 5 years, we have taken out of the system all undergraduate international management students, law students, engineering students, and students studying pure science. Sounds pure. I mean, the definition is somewhat variable. But that's how we are deregulating from the government's control, so we can expand the amount of money we have from other sources.
I'll have another question, if any. If not, I would like to thank you.
Yes, just to go back to the actual government, I'm assuming there's ongoing lobbying, et cetera, but I know that internally here there was a petition put out and there was letters to emanate. Is there value in continuing to pressure at that level?
Absolutely. There's always value in having your voice heard in a democracy. Don't forget, this government was elected, so they have a legitimate right to do the policies that they think are appropriate. We have a legitimate right to suggest that they rethink them. So I know Kim Medeiros started a petition, the 1 in 13 petition, which is really about the fact that for every dollar we get from the Quebec government, the multiplier effect of our economic activity in the city of Montreal is $13. So it's a good deal. It's a good multiplier effect and a nice initiative by a chair of a department in medicine to help us try to convince the government to do something different. So don't give up. We're not going to give up.
Excellent question. I think at that point I'm going to take this opportunity to thank Tony for this talk, but also for his extraordinary dedication and hard work at dealing with this. Just do the thought experiment for a second of putting yourself in his place and trying to deal with all this. I see a lot of people going, oh, no, we can't do that. And I know we all feel that way, so we do appreciate it. We do thank you.
Thank you.
the privilege of making sure that our research and international relations are on target. And I'll keep stalling it for a while you just talk up. There it is. Okay. And take it away, Rosie.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you, David, for the introduction. I always like to say I realize this. I am a member of this faculty.
Where did you sit in this room?
Somewhere near the back. I think I don't remember exactly. I did study in this room, at least officially. So I'm happy to be here today to present on two topics, and also just to come clean on the billing. I think there was a third topic on the McGill University Business Engagement Center, but in the interest of time, in half an hour, I didn't think we could really do it justice. Probably I will talk mostly about the CFI call 7 results and the preliminary debriefing that we've done in our office, mostly internally, talk about our preliminary thoughts on our results and how we can perform better in CFI large scale proposal competitions in the future, and get some of your feedback. I have a short presentation on Cartier d'Innovation, which is related to MOVEBEC and certainly our innovation agenda. I have a feeling we may not get to it in half an hour. And to do the CFI discussion justice, I think the QI presentation speaks for itself, the slides, and you can get them distributed. And I'm also happy to come back. What I want to do is offer to come back to talk about innovation, to talk about MOVEBEC and Cartier d'Innovation, perhaps in more fulsome. So we'll talk about, and as I say, first time, I'm happy to go through the QI slides as well. So as I said, I want to talk about CFI round 7 because it's fresh on our minds. The results have come out recently. And to talk mainly about, to review a little bit the global, participation across the country in CFI, the results nationally and provincially, zone in a little bit on McGill's performance, and in doing so compare to our peer groups, several peer groups, including the top 10 performing universities in Canada in this competition, the U15, and focus a little bit provincially. And as I said, summarize and give you our initial observations. I want to also say that these results are quite new. We've been involved in discussions internally in the office. Some of my staff are here, and they'll help me with questions if you have any. The staff worked very hard on this call 7 with a new internal review process and internal processes put in place. So we admit as well that they did a lot of work. The feedback I've gotten from your faculty and others was excellent, and they were very supportive and really did a wonderful job in the preparation of these proposals and supporting researchers. Having said that, we recognize we're on a learning curve. The results are not as good as we would have liked, and we're certainly looking at how to improve in the future. We know we have a lot to learn, and we want to learn from you. So what we have done so far is gotten the national results. We've debriefed with CFI in particular, various levels all the way up to the highest level. We've debriefed a bit with the province of Quebec, who many of you may know have their own review process, which is separate from how the other provinces engage in the review at the national level. So we've discussed with them, and we've discussed internally what we did and what we could do better. What we haven't done yet, and that's going to start next week, is really talk. We've talked a little bit ad hoc, but to really convene focus groups and some meetings, in particular with principal investigators who were involved in writing proposals this round, investigators who have been successful or not, particularly those successful in previous CFI rounds, and department chairs, medicine, science, engineering, other faculties as well, but those are the main implicated faculties. And frankly, anyone else who has an opinion or who feels they have feedback for how we can improve in the future is hereby invited. We've sent invitations down. Like I said, we'll have focus groups next week, but I want to encourage anyone to ask me questions today, but also to write directly to me if you have further input so that we can... So I'm admitting that the debrief and the consultation is really just starting, and will be more of it next week. So with that introduction, I wanted to start with how the overall numbers for CFI round 7. So as you can see on this slide, the overall funding envelope, which you can see on the right, was $166 million, which is about one-third that of the envelope, the CFI funding in CFI 6. And this is important because it sets the whole stage, and it's really important for the kind of results we saw in CFI. Basically, this was a much smaller competition for large-scale grants than CFI has ever put on before. So based on Tri-Council awards in previous years, each institution, you probably know this, is allotted a maximum amount for which we could apply, and that's known as the institutional envelope, or we fondly, briefly call it the cap, but it's the official name is institutional envelope. For McGill, that envelope was approximately $44 million. So the cap is set approximately three times what the success rate for each institution, what the success rate is approximated. So they aim for, across the board, approximately 30% success rate. So what you see on this slide is how the competition shaped up. 278 letters of intent were submitted to CFI, and they received 240 full applications. That means that 30-something applications did not actually get completed and sent in. So out of the 240, 102 were recommended by the Multidisciplinary Assessment Committee, which we call MAC, at the national level. That's a CFI-run Ottawa committee. Ultimately, out of those 102, the Super MAC, that's the next level of committee, chose 75 projects that are awarded to 34 institutions, and the overall success rate was 36%. Slightly higher than 30% because some of the projects were not actually submitted in full proposal. So this has to do with the project types, and you probably know what LEF and NIF are, the Leading Edge Fund and New Initiative Fund. At the outset of Round 7, CFI this time gave the intention, I think it was an attempt to limit, cut down the number of applications given the small allotment at CFI, the $166 million, and focus the competition on Leading Edge Fund proposals. Basically, these are projects that build on one or two past CFI investments. NIF is a new initiative fund, doesn't have to build on any past investment. So it was stated that at least two-thirds of the funding would go to LEF proposals, and then they followed those. And most Canadian institutions, including us, followed those guidelines and sent in mostly LEF proposals. At the end of the day, a full 88% of the successful projects were in the LEF category. You see that at the top. And the funding was 93% for LEF projects. Now, at McGill, we submitted 9 LEF projects. We submitted 11 projects altogether, very close to our cap in total. 9 LEF projects, or 72% of the total, and 2 NIF projects. I will come back to what we might conclude from that. And just a little teaser there is we could, in hindsight, say, well, maybe that wasn't the right ratio. Maybe, you know, we should have limited the number of NIF. We did limit them. It was only 2. Maybe 1 was the right number. Hindsight is 20/20, but it's something I put out there. We were awarded 3 LEF projects and none of our NIF projects. So again, the success rate in LEF projects was higher across the country, certainly ours as well. It is worth noting for the future that this is not official yet, but indication from CFI, 2 things, is that they will not run a competition of this small magnitude again, they hope. Well, at least they hope, and in fact they plan. They realize that the results were not satisfactory, and they felt too that the small, as we felt, the amount of work involved and the success rate with such a small competition was probably not what they want to do again. So they're very much advocating for. They actually have a bigger budget for the next round. It's about, it's a few hundred. It's certainly $300 or $400 million, probably what they have now from last year's federal budget. But they are asking in this year's budget for more. So again, we're going to advocate it. We believe in that. We need to advocate for CFI to have a richer budget so that they can run a more fulsome competition like they have in the past. But they have indicated as well that they are probably abandoning the whole LEF-NIF designation. And that, I think, will make the discussion of, well, we can certainly talk about what we should have done differently, but I think it will become a moot point for the future. They're actually talking about abandoning having to build on CFI specifically because they recognize there's infrastructure, research infrastructure that's been built across the country that's not necessarily all CFI or maybe partially CFI. It may not even be a CFI at all, yet if it is successful and it needs to be built on, that's something CFI should be looking at. I think that will make our lives easier and really look at what is the best research to be done based on infrastructure we already have from whatever source or based on no infrastructure we have yet but we need to build it. So I think the next competitions will be broader that way and more flexible. So the next slide. In the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about project size, which is another, it's another variable or finding that came out that is really linked to the size of the competition again. So the MAC committees look at projects in these 3 categories, small or under 2 million, medium, I call them, between 2 and 7, or the larger projects over 7 million. Over 99% of the projects awarded were below $7 million per project. So in other words, if you take the first 2 columns, you get to 90-something percent of the projects and most of the funding, right, 95% of the funding. So nationwide, only 1 project in the large category was awarded, over $7 million. The overall mean size of the awards was $2.2 million. So compared to previous rounds, and in particular we looked at round 6, you can see that there's a trend toward the smaller projects. And again, I think that's linked to the one-third available budget. So what did McGill submit and how did we do? We submitted two small projects, so in the first column, less than $2 million, 8 mid-range projects, and 1 large-scale project. I should say the large-scale project did get all the way to the supermac. It was very highly rated and did come quite close. The mean size of McGill submitted projects was $4 million, almost twice the national mean of $2.2 million. So again, that begs the question, were our projects a little bit too large, given, you know, again, hindsight, but given the situation? And I think it's an important lesson for the future based on, you know, maybe it's gaming the size of the grants and the size of the envelope. I think there is something to be learned there. Having said that, what I should have said too is, of the two small-scale projects, one was funded. Okay, it's a small number. The N is small, but it's 50%. Of the 8 projects in the mid-range, 2 were funded, 25%, and the 1 large-scale project wasn't. So one could, I think, make the argument that smaller projects maybe would have been more work, might have been more successful. And I think for the future, it makes us really think about, which we did think about, but the size of the competition and the size of the grants and trying to figure that out. Part of our strategy in the internal review process was to match projects up. We did suggest with principal investigators' agreement, et cetera, to collaborate more. There were various reasons that we did that. Some of that meant that some of the projects became larger rather than smaller, and we admit that perhaps that didn't favor some of our projects. It's something we have to think about for the future. So this is breaking down per research field. I won't spend a lot of time on it, so I think this is not really that controversial. You see how many projects awarded were in health. It remains that in previous competitions, including 6, was a very similar distribution, and our distribution of projects submitted were similar. Mostly health, some engineering. Environment and social sciences, there were more funded this time around, a little bit more. Again, the numbers are small. I don't think they're statistically significant, but the numbers are a little bit higher, and in science. So I think, in general, this is not surprising. I don't think it would make us really change. So I've already alluded to what McGill did, our performance, but I'll summarize here. We submitted 11 applications. This was $43.9 million, which was basically very close to our cap. 4 projects were recommended by MAC. I should start by saying, in the Quebec process, 100% of our projects were approved, highly recommended, and sent to the CFI process in Ottawa. This has not always been the case in the past where the numbers were 60%, 70%. So all of our projects, there were a few projects held back from other institutions, but none of ours. So once they went to Ottawa, 4 projects were recommended by the next level, by the MAC, and 3 projects awarded. We also were awarded 1 project where we are a major partner. UBC is the lead, and I'll mention which one that is as well. This means that $10.9 million CFI funds were awarded to McGill in this competition. It's a total of $27 million if you count our partners and provincial matching. As I mentioned, 100% of our projects were recommended by Quebec. So I will mention the 3 projects we were awarded as lead institution, and 2 of them are in, one is in medicine, one is in dentistry, one is a $4.8 million to Calgary for structural biology at the crossroads of biology and medicine, $1.5 to Mark McKee in the Faculty of Dentistry, and of course, and all their partners for multi-scale imaging and analysis of biological systems and biomaterials in nanomedicine, and a $4.5 million grant to Peter Gruder in the Faculty of Science, tools for nanoscience and technology upgrade. In our analysis, it's also been clear that these were quite technical. They're platforms. They tend to be platforms. They tend to have a lot of intra-institutional collaboration, providing a platform for other investigators at McGill and at other institutions, having industrial partners, et cetera. These are all very important factors, which, frankly, some of our applications were not strong enough in compared to nationally. The UBC-led project, nearly $5 million CFI project. I don't know the amount. About $1.6 million will come to Faculty of Science to Matt Dobbs in physics. It's a digital radio telescope for CHIME, 3-dimensional mapping of the largest volume of the universe to date. So we are a very strong partner there as well. So we're very proud of that 4th project, even though it doesn't get allotted to us as a lead. I'll show you on the next slide, too, where McGill ranked in terms of nationally and with its peers. So this is where McGill lands up on the top 10 institutions in terms of amount of CFI funding awarded. So you can see that UBC is at the top in terms of market share, not in total amount, at 13.7%, and We are fourth in our market share. I should note that University of Montreal does not include Ecole Polytechnique here. If you include Ecole Polytechnique, we actually flip. They become four and we're five. Depending on the who does the analysis and which competition, Polytechnique and HEC are with Montreal or not. What you can see is that our market share, the market share at UBC in Toronto is very good. It drops quite precipitously at University of Alberta and then at McGill. 6.5% is roughly the market share, the percentage of all the CFI funds that we took in nationally. It's like almost exactly the same as CFI 6. And that's really where we're underperforming. The 10 million total is the fourth in the country. That's not bad when you look at it that way, but our market share is really below. It's certainly below where we are in terms of our strength as a research university. So as the University of Montreal is also in the top 10, as is INRS. So this is where we really are not punching our weight or getting our share. If we look at the U15, what this table shows is that, and in this table, all of the institutions, it's important to note, include the affiliated hospitals. So University of Toronto near the top, is a $33 million CFI award. That's University of Toronto and all its hospitals. University of Montreal includes Polytechnique and HEC, so you can see they're a little bit above McGill because those are included. What I think is really important here is, first of all, if you look at share of the national pot or market share, the U15 takes 82%, over 80% of the national market. All the other universities get under 20%. So we kind of forget, okay, the other universities get a very small piece each. If you look at the 80% that U15 take, Toronto's getting 20% of that pot. UBC's getting 12%. And if you scroll down, we're getting half of what UBC is getting, 6.5%. Again, that's market share. And really, if you compare to UBC, quite bluntly, we have twice as many we're getting half as much of the market share that UBC is punching. So UBC and certainly and also even Alberta are punching above their weight for their research strength and their cap, their research total research dollars, and we're at half that. So it's another indication that we're not punching at our weight in terms of getting, certainly in this round, getting our share of the pot. Now, two members of the U15, Manitoba, Dalhousie, didn't even get anything. So it's clearly there are winners and losers in all of this. But I think that the important statistic is, yes, Queen's did reasonably well. And it's interesting, Queen's got a lot of small projects. You start to look at, you see they have six projects. We had three and then six. Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's what I'm focusing on here. Toronto gets nearly 50% of its cap. UBC is getting nearly 50%. U of A, and then it drops. And some of the ones, especially Queens. Queens is an outlier. Queens, if you look at it, they have six small projects. We have three medium projects, and they manage. They got more. Their cap is smaller. They have less research dollars. Again, goes to my point that strategy was obviously more winning. The Quebec universities in general. University of Montreal also punched below its weight for the cap and for the national for the take. Now McGill does rank. The good news part, I know that the bad news part is that we're fourth in the country in CFI amount. We're fifth among the U15 here, but we admit there's a drop. Right? We're fifth, but we're below a drop. The standout performers are certainly UBC, Alberta, University of Toronto, as always. But UBC, as in other areas, is punching up. They're the ones who are taking up what we're not taking up. Frankly, it's the West taking up, but the East is not taking up. And that brings me to the province. And you can see here that Quebec is getting 25% of its CFI envelope. It's not just McGill. It's Quebec. It's more striking to us, maybe because we're McGill and also because of our research intensiveness. But I submit here, and certainly CFI sees this, that this is not a McGill-specific problem per se. It is a Quebec problem as well. So you can see that and if you look at the average, I think a nice way to look at it is if you look at the total, the percentage of CFI envelope, the success rate is about 35% overall for the country. And if you look at that, we're 10% below that average. So we're getting 25% of the CFI envelope when Ontario, as in previous years, is taking more than the average, 40%. BC is taking more than the average, 51%, and the rest you can see. So we're the province that's really hitting below the average of the CFI envelope, or the other provinces are taking up the rest. So basically, the Quebec government sees this as well, that Quebec has not done well in this competition. And as I said, we've talked to CFI about this, we've talked to Quebec, we've looked at what is also very clear qualitatively, and I've alluded to it, is that Quebec sent in 100% of our projects with strong support. But when the MAC looked at that, there, and this was not just for McGill, it was for other universities of Quebec as well, they reversed some of those decisions. So they, there was not a good alignment, or reversed some of the rankings, so that there, and recommendations for funding. So there was not a good alignment between the Quebec process and the recommendations and what happened later at the MAC and the Super MAC. And anyways, that is really one of our the major conclusions. So I'll try to summarize what we've learned. Basically that, of course, we're disappointed that we didn't do better, that we didn't do better in terms of our cap and what we succeeded to get in a percentage envelope, but also our national market share. And certainly disappointing in Quebec as well, for Quebec at large, and we're a big part of that. Part of what was very unique about this competition was it was a small envelope. That changed some of the dynamics. And what certainly became clear was that some of our projects had some weaknesses. There was no room for weaknesses, or at least some weaknesses that the MAC perceived, not perceived at the Quebec expert panel so much. So that although we had excellent projects, everyone is putting forward excellent projects. And anything which detracts even slightly, at more than ever before, especially in a small competition, gets you out of the competition. So we do have to have even stronger proposals. Having said that, there were lessons learned that that I've already alluded to. Maybe one or two more LEFT projects and not NIF projects would have added to the success. The other thing is that the numbers were so small, we did some calculations that if we had actually gotten maybe one more project, certainly the large project, we would have been number one in the country. So you have to realize that too. Like if we had the CHIME project was McGill and UBC, and if we had led that, it was kind of led by us at one point, led by them. If we had been the leaders, and we'd added that $5 or $6 million to ours, we would have jumped as well. So we have to be careful. It's kind of like a small study, right? The number, small changes in numbers can make a big difference in your ranking. What we did learn in terms of our applications was also that we need more cross, and we got this in our feedback. We need more collaboration across the country. We need to be less McGill-centric in our research projects. We need to be collaborating more in the province, in the country, internationally, and with business. Our applications are not as strong as certainly UBC. We have to start to work on that. We also need to advocate and work with CFI and Quebec government on the Quebec process. Without getting into the details, the selection process, the committees, were way different than how Ottawa structures them. There's a CFI observer on those panels, so the CFI observers can give us feedback, and certainly I am planning with our Quebec universities, but also with CFI, to advocate and to work with Quebec to have a more robust process at the Quebec level. It didn't serve us well, and I hope they will. I don't know if they realize. I hope they will. It did not serve us well to have a Quebec process which did not stand up, which frankly did not stand up to be credible when it got to the MAC in Ottawa. That just didn't. We had great recommendations for funding, but they didn't hold up. So that needs to be worked on. And lastly, I want to say is we have to do this consultation with you to really understand our own internal processes, how we reviewed them, how we set up committees, getting external reviewers to assist with applications early on. But more than anything, my words are, we know that we need to be more proactive with you. We need to be, now that the strategic research plan university has been delivered and your strategic research plan for medicine and dentistry will be delivered soon, it's the right timing. We have all of the work behind us to actually start to be proactive and work on the major projects, not just for CFI, but for all the major institutional projects, but particularly CFI, to start to always be working on those priorities. We need to start to work now proactively with you. I want to figure out with you how we can best support you to write these grants, how we can best provide the support in the faculties that's needed. My office can only support it and work with you. And really learn from you how we can support you better and how we can make these projects stronger. But one of it is we need enough time to do that. We need to have deadlines that work, internal deadlines. So we need to work with you to make that happen. We need help getting external reviewers, because we know that good reviews of these proposals early on is very important and helps a lot. And we need the opportunity to do that. We need the right timing. We also need to build the kinds of partnerships I talked about now, before there's a competition. It's too late when we usually are asking you to find partners. We have to have those partners now. And we also have other ways of funding these kinds of proposals early on or even later, which will strengthen, I wouldn't say obviate the need for CFI funding, but actually strengthen the case for CFI funding and also provide some funding because we're not always going to be successful. So that's my plea to you, to work with us so we can be more proactive. There will be a call 8 I believe there will be. It will be larger than the last one, but it won't be as large as they ever were. And probably be in about 12 to 18 months. So actually, now is the time where we really do need to start to talk about the projects, build them, and not do them. I do know that, my last thing I'll say is I do know a lot about what UBC does and what we don't do. That's the same. And one of the major factors is planning very far in advance. And so that's what we need to do.
Okay, thank you very much, Rosie. Are there questions, comments, suggestions? Dr. Wolfson.
So the question I have is that applying for a CFI is a very different thing than anything else that anybody ever does. And I just wonder, in terms of the consultation process that you have at your office and is done at McGill, are there people involved in that who have been through the process successfully with a CFI who are actually providing advice on the writing and, you know, just some of the scientific aspects?
I think the answer is yes,
okay.
But perhaps not enough, not enough of them. So we invite others but definitely. And we've had people from outside McGill advising as well who've worked at CFI, who have also been successful at CFI. But I think you can't do enough of that. And also not in every, you know, and every field is different, and the timing is different. And this was a different competition, you know. So I'm not sure we adjusted to that reality quickly enough. So I think CFI is disappointed enough in what happened to make the next competition also less quirky, you know. So you know, and
Dr. Carbonetto.
I just have a comment about my one experience with CFI, and it wasn't in the past round, but the round prior. We sent an application in, and it was folded into another one. I think it completely lost its coherence. It went out of the province and so forth, but didn't get funded, not to my surprise at all. My point is, I thought that decision was quite opaque. We didn't get any chance. We didn't get any explanation of why we were folded in with another one, and we didn't get any idea of what the range of possibilities were, or what the options were, or, as I said, the rationale for why it was folded in. So I would suggest that there be some kind of discussion with the applicants to when those decisions are made, and some explanation of what's been done, or how, whether it could be done better. Or
I think that's more of a comment than a question. I agree with you, and I can't comment on the previous round. I'd like to say there certainly was an attempt this round to have those kind of discussions, whether they were the right discussions, satisfactory, whether they, and I would, you know, I've submitted myself that maybe some of the decisions were not, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but I agree with you. We at least have to engage in consultation where people feel that, for better or for worse, the right decision's been made.
Yeah, I guess my point is that I felt that my application was substantially graded by the decision.
Yeah. And I think that does happen, and we want to avoid that. I guess I'm agreeing with you.
You mentioned planning ahead was the UBC success part of it. Could you see that in our own, some of ours made it and some didn't? Do you see that same pattern there, or is it, can you read that into that, or not really?
I'm looking at Natalie, who knew them more intimately. Yes and no, right? I mean, I think it's true to say that there were some that we thought would have been much stronger had we had a longer time. That's true. And more time, so there's no question that some of the weaknesses that came back, we knew they were there, and there wasn't enough time to really remedy. But Natalie probably can.
I think we started trying to really make an effort to start selecting projects really ahead of time. We really start to work that a year before the MOI was to be submitted. So we really tried to really do this effort of giving sufficient time to each project that we selected, and we have a chance to go forward, you know, to be implemented, improved, and so on. And I know that this is very difficult and complicated to do that. But I think that even if we still need to do a kind of internal selection process to identify new projects and give sufficient time, I think we do not need to wait for the next competition with this process. I think right now, in the Faculty of Medicine at least, you should already know what are the strategic projects you want to go forward with. One idea also that I had in mind is about the past funded projects.
currently, I'm not sure that we are making an assessment of those FAST-funded projects to see how are they evolving, are they going in the right direction, and what helps do you need now to get to the next level and come back maybe for funding and getting additional funding for the next CFI competition. This is, in my opinion, one way where we could do some improvement to what we are doing, just by looking at how our past-funded projects are already evolving and inviting to these the Faculty of Medicine, but also some administrators who knows that could give you some ideas or to say, okay, let's go to these funding sources, let's do this, let's try to find a partnership in that direction to make sure that next time when there will be a competition and when we will do this internal review process, you will be ready for that. So I think we need to have mechanism here that internally we try to identify little projects that can make sense, that we help building with you, and then we can do this internal review process for selection of the projects we think have sufficient potential to really get up to the point where we think they are fundable projects. But still, we need really time. You need time. We need time for making this review.
Yes, I think thank you, Natalie. And so I think one of the answers is I think a lot of these, we know what other universities do. And we know what's worked for us successfully. But often it's having enough time. Starting a year before sounds like a lot, but it needs the cooperation of you grant writers and PIs working with us, helping us find external reviewers when we need them, and really taking the advice and the feedback and working with us. We also have to provide better support where that's needed, so that actually, because sometimes we're working a year in advance, but we're not advancing during that year. And we need more, frankly, we need more collaboration on both sides to be able to do the right things.
Say that this has been a perennial frustration of mine, is to show up. I've been on the internal review panels for CFI in previous incarnations, and it's always obvious that when people are chasing around trying to find an industrial partner or something like this, it lasts 5 minutes, and that's just not going to work. Dr. Rosenblatt.
So my comments are repeats on the last one. I've been a part of CFI's went somewhere else, but also seeing them tied to
opportunity to get the money, and like the way we are supposed to track graduate students and see whether they're really ending up in positions that we want, or can we maybe use the research strategy approach and say, what do we really need for our research focus to go ahead and build our CFIs around things we want to go ahead to make sure they're successful?
Our strategic platform.
Research.
Absolutely.
Well, that's why I was looking at Dr. Grove. But no, because I worry that, I mean, obviously, if there's a game, you want to get your share of the pot. But I also worry about it. I think it's a very wasteful program. I would have loved to see that money put into the councils rather than, you know, I think these are very wasteful projects, but better than nothing.
Is there a question in there?
Can we track what's actually happened to everybody who's won, what's happened to every piece of equipment, what's happened to every, you know, that type of thing.
So I have two questions. The first is, will you align so the selection process and internally tied to strategic initiatives that have been set by the university and by each unit, by the faculty? And instead of trying to merge and cut down the number of projects going forward by forcing a fusion, will you stratify based on the strategic plans that are being formulated from each of the units and make decisions coming out of McGill? That's one. And two, what was Quebec's response to the fact that they forwarded 100%? And I imagine there must have been a lot of resentment coming from the panel, the federal panel, looking at grants that weren't ranked, and did they respond to you in any way?
So the first question is a bit easier in terms of we always look at strategic research plan and have to justify these projects. But going forward, I think we can be more proactive using your strategic research plan and the universities as a background. Having said that, we always look at the faculties and to what your projects, what are your priorities. The dean's got to sign off on them, and your faculty has to say they're a priority, or our committees and our office won't even start looking at them. So again, so the question is, really, the answer is really yes. And I think now that we have a fresh strategic research plan, it's an opportune moment to start planning what are the projects you want to put forward. Some of the merging, just to go back to that, and choosing is because we're forced with this very small cap. You know, it's not as if we can blue sky it. There, in the end of the day, we can only send in X million dollars of ask, and sometimes we have to make some pretty hard choices. And we have investigators that say, sometimes, we make a lot of hard choices, and we have investigators that say, no, mine's got to be 4 million. If you make it 3.8, the project doesn't work. You know, so that, you have to work with us. You know,
much better than zero.
Well, you have to work with us. The second question about disappointment and all that, certainly nationally, there you can see it in the reviews, that the national, the MAC, et cetera, were not very happy looking at Quebec reviews that they considered they had to sort of that didn't seem to jive and didn't match. I haven't had the in-depth conversation with Quebec government yet about how they feel about the outcome of the process. They've been busy with stuff.
Dr. Groh has a final question.
So, you know, I mean, when I look at the results, I think that, you know, this particular round was somewhat of an outlier. I heard your comment that you said that if we would have gotten the large CFI application, we would have been number one. Well, I submit to you that's probably the other way around that it happened, is the committee looked at it to say, where can we cut to preserve our percentage funding and to fund a greater number of applications? So they rather inflict pain to a single entity, and the one that they're going to pick is going to be the largest one. So I think that your point of we should have been a bit more strategic, maybe we should have had smaller applications, smaller envelopes. Of course, hindsight's always 20/20, but you know, I think that the maths might have worked better for us in that instance.
That's the point. We don't know.
I want to thank Rosie for standing up here and taking this, these questions and giving her presentation. And I'm sure we're going to do better next time. I want to thank Tony again for his presentation. Thank you all for coming this evening. I think you were very wise. Thank you.